Hi, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the Austrian Circle. This is the program where we talk about the economics of freedom here on WHUS Stores 91.7 FM. So thank you very much for tuning into my show this morning. We are going to be talking about war on the show today. The recent announcement that Obama was going to go back into Iraq again for the fourth president in a row going back into Iraq. We are going to talk about war. War is an incredibly important topic for libertarians. We have a lot to offer in terms of philosophy in this particular area because we adhere to the non-aggression principle. We believe that it is wrong in all cases to murder, to kill, to attack, to assault, to rape, to steal, to invade private property rights is always illegitimate. And war amounts to one of the greatest violations of property rights that mankind has ever known. The destruction wrought by the weapons that the state creates, the bombs, the nuclear weapons, the missiles and bullets that they use, not only destroy the civilian people and take their lives immediately and directly, but they also destroy things that the civilian population relies on for their own quality of life and their own well-being. Destroy sanitation organizations, hospitals, trucks, things that people use, plumbing. It completely devastates the civilian population. And the destruction wrought not only by the actual killing of the civilians, but also the dislocation where they have to move their refugees and they run away from these bombs and they're in abject terror from these weapons that are being used against them. This violation of property rights is almost ghastly for us to think about. And we oppose war, if nothing more, for the violation of property rights and the death and destruction that it always brings. And we also recognize that war originates from and is really only possible because of taxation. The government forces people to pay for these wars, whether or not those people actually want the wars, whether they like the wars, whether they feel that they're safer as a result of the wars. Whether or not you like them or not, you are going to pay for them regardless, whether the government takes money directly from you or whether it funds it indirectly through inflation by printing the money that it needs or by borrowing from other states. People are paying for these wars, whether or not people actually want the wars. And there's no accountability there. I'm not able to withdraw my funds because I do not approve of the way that they're being used, in the same way that I would withdraw my funds from any private organization that I did not feel was actually serving my interest and providing me with the goods that I actually would like. When we have taxation, we have no choice. There is no ideas that the people can put forward that will actually withdraw funds from this massive destruction and killing and maiming and bombing and all of the things that come along with war. And so with this in mind, let us turn our view to Iraq and the Islamic State, or ISIL, or ISIS, this organization that has come about in the Middle East and has set itself up to be a national state, basically. They want to take over a lot of the Middle East. They have plans to take over Africa and parts of Europe and, you know, parts of more of the Russian area. They want to take over a lot of land and set themselves up as a European Union type of national state, but an Islamic, a very violent state. And of course, these guys are incredibly violent. They are beheading people. They are attacking people. They are taxing people. Of course, this is a very violent organization. But we have to look very closely at this because, you know, a lot of people are calling for the destruction of ISIS. They're saying that we need to go in and attack these guys. And even some libertarians have come forward and said, these guys are terrible, they're evil, we have to attack them, we have to stop them from hurting innocent people. And this looks like a valid claim. I oppose violence. That is the non-aggression principle. Libertarians are always against violence. And so we cannot stand for this type of organization going around and killing people and attacking people and stealing from people. That is not obviously not legitimate, but we have to look very carefully because when the state says it wants to do something, there's generally some kind of other motive involved here. And I think, and Justin Raimondo also thinks, that this is a backdoor into Syria. Remember not too long ago, the U.S. government was saying, we've got to bomb Syria, you know, this bad guy, Assad. He was attacking his own people. He had chemical weapons, and we have to go in there and teach him a lesson and stuff. And so that didn't happen because you wonderful people out there stood up and said, no more war. We no longer want you to invade this new country. We don't want any more of these wars. They cost us too much money. They cost us blood. They kill people. We don't want it. And so you lovely people out there stood up and said no. And so he had to pull back. And so they needed another excuse. And that's what they're saying they're going to do. They're going to bomb parts of Syria, and they're going to use this, I believe, as a backdoor into Syria to go and invade Syria when they weren't able to before. So, again, this is what Justin Raimondo thinks. And I'm going to read for you the Iraq War 3, Obama's Operation Double Talk. Again, this article is by Justin Raimondo. In the run-up to World War II, Franklin Roosevelt played the role of the reluctant warmonger. Rather than initiating the action, he took care to be always responding to the war cries of his hopped-up left-wing supporters, who were demanding U.S. intervention on behalf of the beleaguered Soviet Union. The American people wanted to stay out of the European war, and the president had to ever so cautiously lead them down the primrose path, deceiving them every step of the way, while he and Winston Churchill plotted behind their backs to get us into the war. As the 1940 campaign came down to the wire, Roosevelt intoned, quote, I have said this before, but I shall say it again and again and again. You boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars. A year later, in alliance with Uncle Joe Stalin, we were at war on two fronts. Back then, it took the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and the death of 2,400 service members and civilians to get us into a world war. Today, it takes a video of the horrific deaths of two American journalists traveling in a war zone, played over and over in an infinite loop of orchestrated hysteria. If they'd only had YouTube in Roosevelt's day, he would have succeeded in lying us into war much sooner. In an age where imagery takes the place of text and of rational thought, the ISIS Public Relations Department certainly knows its business. If the whole point of using social media to transmit horrific images of their deeds is to lure us into re-invading Iraq, then they succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. While it seems like only yesterday that the president disdained ISIS as a junior varsity, today he is mobilizing a mighty worldwide coalition to wipe out a group he claims is capable of attacking the United States. And it must be said that if the president is employing FDR's old methods, he has none of the old boy's charm. Addressing the American people like a rather testy teacher who, one can plainly see, would rather be almost anywhere else, Obama launched into his dreary peroration, exuding a skunk-like aura of insincerity. No flowery, inspiring introduction, no soaring rhetoric to thrill the slavering masses, already pumped up by our war-mad media, just the matter-of-fact, bare-bones edict of the master of the world. Quote, My fellow Americans, tonight I want to speak to you about what the United States will do with our friends and allies to degrade and ultimately destroy the terrorist group known as ISIL. Note the use of the future tense and the certainty with which the president asserts it. Quote, I want to speak to you about what the United States will do. Although the Constitution forbids it, American presidents have been taking us into war without congressional consent ever since Harry Truman bypassed the Republican isolationists and sent U.S. troops to Korea. This president, like any Roman Caesar, claims the power to take us into war by a simple act of will. Some in Congress are questioning this on both sides of the aisle, but we'll see how far that gets. Not very far, I suspect. The Presley into a campaign commercial extolling his achievements in the war on terrorism. We got bin Laden, we sewed up Yemen, and we knocked off that dude in Somalia. And all these shiny presents come packaged in the rhetoric of war-weary isolationism. Quote, "We've done so while bringing more than 140,000 American troops home from Iraq and drawing down our forces in Afghanistan, where our combat mission will end later this year. Thanks to our military and counterterrorism professionals, America is safer." Obama's makeup as a quintessentially political creature is here on full display. He knows perfectly well the American people, in their present mood, won't tolerate talk of new wars unless it's framed by the promise of some respite. Oh, yes, and America is safer. Gee, that's funny. But Americans don't feel any safer. Could that be due to the panic-mongering of government officials and their media megaphones who are ginning up fear of a bunch of savages situated somewhere out in the no-man's land between Iraq and Syria? Amid all the requisite condemnations of the Islamic State's supposedly unique brutality, Obama blandly says of them, quote, "they kill children." Can he really not be aware of the alarming proportion of children among Gaza's dead? Mustering all his capacity for professorial disdain, Obama declaims, quote, "now let's make two things clear. ISIL is not Islamic. No religion condones the killing of innocents. And ISIL is certainly not a state." Two gigantic lies, or rather self-delusions, packed into a very few sentences. This is the only sort of frugality practiced by government officials. Of course, practically every religion has condoned the killing of innocents at one time or another. Al-Qaeda and like-minded folk don't call us the Crusaders for nothing. And it all depends on how one defines innocence. The idea that there are no innocents among the residents of Gaza has recently gained an alarming popularity in Israel. And as for his claim that the Islamic State is certainly not a state, the president's tone is rather too defensive. He says, quote, "it is recognized by no government nor by the people it subjugates. But none of these factors are relevant in determining what constitutes a state, which is nothing more or less than a monopoly on the use of force in a given territory. The horror that is ISIL is merely the process of state formation looked at up close. The terror they employ is simply an exaggerated rendition of how every state gains its legitimacy by definitively establishing its coercive monopoly. While ISIL is doing so in a particularly graphic manner, in principle it is acting no differently than any other embryonic state in history, benign creation myths to the contrary notwithstanding." So much for theory. Now we get down to the actual practice. So what is the grand strategy behind Iraq War III? Yes, there will be airstrikes, and some 475 more troops will go to Iraq, but, quote, "these American forces will not have a combat mission. We will not get dragged into another ground war in Iraq." And by the way, this isn't really a war. It's a, quote, "comprehensive and sustained counterterrorism strategy." But of course, it is a war when our pilots are flying over enemy territory dropping bombs, and this is apparently the linchpin of our strategy, airstrikes, which Obama vows will occur not only in Iraq, but also in Syria, and therein lies the key to understanding this latest bout of war hysterics. Quote, "across the border in Syria," the president announced, "we have ramped up our military assistance to the Syrian opposition. Tonight, I call on Congress again to give us additional authorities and resources to train and equip these fighters. In the fight against ISIL, we cannot rely on an Assad regime that terrorizes its own people, a regime that will never again regain the legitimacy it has lost. Instead, we must strengthen the opposition as the best counterweight to extremists like ISIL, while pursuing the political solution necessary to solve Syria's crisis once and for all." This is the real crux of the matter, and the actual reason for this intensive barrage of war propaganda. It's a backdoor way to carry out regime change in Syria. Stopped from bombing Syria in direct support of the Islamist rebels by an upsurge of anti-war sentiment, the president is using the execution of two American journalists as a pretext to intervene in the Syrian civil war in a big way. the fact that Sotlov, and quite possibly Foley, was kidnapped by the very rebel group we have been supporting with arms and money all along, the, quote, Free Syrian Army, doesn't enter into the equation. That's because Washington's contempt for the American people collectively is no less virulent than it is in the case of individuals, such as the family of Stephen Sotlov, whose sources have confirmed the treachery of the U.S.-supported, quote, moderates, and whose treatment at the hands of this administration has been shameful. Just as Roosevelt took the, quote, back door to war in 1941, inching ever closer to full engagement with the enemy, but not so fast as to startle the American people, so Obama is taking the back door to regime change in Syria, easing us into it slowly until the next traumatic event catalyzes a new wave of war hysteria that will take us up to the next level. This is what Hillary Clinton fought for during her tenure at the State Department, together with David Petraeus. The two of them plotted and schemed to use the Syrian rebels as a battering ram against Bashar al-Assad, and then, standing behind him, Iran. So they're getting their Syrian war anyway. The war party, always a sore loser, never takes a defeat lying down. In undertaking this new military adventure, which will no doubt be given some pretentious moniker, might I suggest Operation Double Talk, President Obama is laying the groundwork for his presumed successor, who will pursue it with far more alacrity than he has shown. The Islamic State is merely a pretext. The real objective of Operation Double Talk is regime change in Syria and minimizing Iranian influence in the region. As ISIL seeks to fill the power vacuum left by the destruction of the Iraqi Baathist regime, the America's re-entry into the region marks the beginning of Iraq War III, which looks to be an expanded version of the first two conflicts. Now the matter goes to Congress, or does it? They don't seem too eager to put their impromptu on this war, for reasons that are perfectly understandable. And that should tell you all you need to know about the latest U.S. crusade for truth, justice, and the American way. The whole project stinks to high heaven. It literally reeks with the overripe aroma of failure, and no one in Congress wants to touch it with a 10-foot pole. Our warbirds may be crowing triumphantly now, but I give it a few weeks before the reaction sets in, and they're drowned out by questions about just what we've gotten ourselves into this time. That article was by Justin Raimondo. He is the editorial director of antiwar.com and a senior fellow at the Randolph Bourne Institute. Michael S. Rozef also agrees with this idea that the real target is Syria. It's not the Islamic State. He writes on lewrockwell.com, Obama's latest war. We read, quote, the House on Wednesday approved President Obama's plan to train and equip moderate Syrian rebels to counter the growing threat of the Islamic State terrorist organization, even though lawmakers in both parties remain deeply skeptical about its chances for success. If we believe what we are reading, the goal is to counter IS, the Islamic State. How might that be done if Washington actually wanted to do that? How about mobilizing those states in the region that are very close allies of the U.S., who have received a great deal of aid and military equipment over the years, who have military links to the U.S., and who have significant armed forces? There are these powers like Israel, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. There are also Jordan, Egypt, and even Iraq. But no. Instead, Obama plans to arm and train a group known as the Syrian Moderate Rebels. This group has fought beside the IS fighters. It has links to IS. It, or parts of it, even recently signed a truce with IS. IS can infiltrate this group, can attack it, and can steal more American-supplied weapons. Why would Obama arm this group of hard-to-control people whose loyalties are so questionable, who cannot whip IS and who don't want to, and who will probably actually end up helping the Islamic State? Beyond the folly of it, there is a reason. We also read, quote, Obama and administration officials have said that some aid may go to the Syrian Free Army, a group focused on defeating Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. This is the real purpose of the Obama plan. It is to train and arm anti-Assad rebels, the goal being to defeat Assad. The larger goal is to weaken Iran and Hezbollah by creating a new government in Syria. This is a pro-Israel strategy. This too is folly, but that's what Washington does. In the Iraq case, Congress bought the propaganda. This time around, the Congress is voting for the folly, knowing full well that it is folly. Has Congress given any thought to the fact that the U.S. is, with its approval and participation, openly aggressing against Syria? Can anyone in Washington make a case against Russia for anything it has done in Ukraine? That article is by Michael S. Rozef. It was called Obama's Latest War, and you can read it on lewrockwell.com. So finally on the show today, I would like to read an article by Daniel Sanchez, and it's called Our Enemy Maker, the State. And it talks a little bit about how the state creates all of these enemies and then pretends to protect us from them. The state is the archenemy of the individual, as has been demonstrated by libertarian state analysis from Herbert Spencer to Albert J. Nock to Murray Rothbard. However, it is not only our chief enemy, it is also our chief maker of enemies. The parasitic state is not only perpetually at odds with us, but it is constantly setting us at odds with others. It is not only a millstone around our necks, but a target. States make enemies on behalf of its subjects, primarily because threats make it easier to marshal support from the frightened and indignant public for expansions of its power, both home and abroad. This is agreed upon by both opponents and practitioners of this policy. Rothbard wrote that, quote, "The state has for centuries used the foreign threat to aggrandize its power over its deluded subjects." The leading Nazi, Hermann Göring, stated at the Nuremberg trials that, quote, "It is the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it is always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship or a parliament or a communist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked." This aspect of the state has been especially important in recent news. The burgeoning Islamic State, or ISIS, seems straight out of supervillain central casting. And when the political class isn't panicking over ISIS, it is scaremongering over the imperial designs of Vladimir Putin. Radical Islam. Tyranny and war both breed fanaticism. Of course, arming and training fanatics does too. The U.S. and its regional allies have been the biggest supporters of fanaticism in the Muslim world in all three regards. The shell-shocked Sunni population only tolerates such madmen because they consider them useful in throwing off and keeping off the yoke of the U.S.-sponsored sectarian Shia government in Baghdad, which is even more horrendous to them than theocratic terrorists. If the U.S. government cared about the security of Americans more than its power in the region, it would pull out of Iraq entirely, foreign aid, embassy, CIA, and all, and leave the Baghdad regime to its own devices. Only then would it be motivated to come to a mutually tolerable understanding with the Sunnis, and only such an understanding would cause the Sunni tribal leaders to turn their backs on ISIS. That would be the only way to, quote, "drain the swamp," to use George W. Bush's phrase, in which ISIS terrorism breeds. However, the U.S. government seems hell-bent on flooding that swamp, as its policy in Syria indicates. ISIS could not have staged its initial conquest of northwestern Iraq had the U.S. and its allies not propped up the jihadist-filled rebellion of wannabe rulers in Syria, which let much of it become a safe haven for ISIS, which was taking part in the rebellion. The U.S.-sponsored regimes in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, and Turkey, even the U.S. itself, directly supported Sunni radical rebels in Syria, like those that fill the ranks of ISIS. And that is only the U.S. role in ISIS's most recent growth spurt. The chaotic American invasion of Iraq is what fostered ISIS's initial emergence as al-Qaeda in Iraq. The war on terror, including its humanitarian and smart power extension under Obama, has in effect been nothing more than a terrorist cultivation program. When the U.S. and its proxies are not supporting jihadists, they are making new jihadists through the radicalizing effect of their brutalities, which, as John Stockwell put it, quote, "leave behind for each one of the dead perhaps five loved ones who are now traumatically conditioned to violence and hostility toward the United States." It is like when Mickey Mouse and the Sorcerer's Apprentice hacked to pieces a pesky living broom he had conjured. Each splinter then became a new broom, turning his predicament into an overwhelming crisis. Similarly, the War on Terror has only made more enemies for us, for every foreigner it kills, maims, and tortures. At the rate that American foreign policy is going, it may only be a matter of months before we are again struck by a major terrorist attack. Terrorist enemies are bad enough, but the biggest danger they pose to us is not in the direct damage that they inflict to our persons and property, but in their capacity to terrorize us into giving our own government license to bankrupt us by expanding the warfare state and crush us under its heel by expanding the police state. Indeed, that has been the Bin Laden game plan all along. Nuclear Russia. The matter is somewhat different when our government picks fights on our behalf with massive nuclear powers, as Washington did with Russia all throughout the Cold War. Such cases can also result in bankruptcy and domestic tyranny, but they also involve flirting with nuclear holocaust. When Moscow abandoned revolutionary communism and dissolved both the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union itself, the U.S. had no excuse to maintain NATO, much less expand it. Yet it subsequently expanded that military alliance all the way to Russia's border, a policy which even George Kennan, the grand old man of the Cold War, said would be, quote, the most fateful error of American policy in the entire post-Cold War era. Moscow explicitly warned Washington that pulling Ukraine into NATO's orbit would be a bridge too far, as it considered a non-antagonistic relationship with that neighboring country as absolutely essential to its own security. The Obama administration breezily skipped over this red line by supporting an anti-Russian putsch in Kiev. And it has responded to Putin's power politics countermoves by waging a vilification campaign and a sanction war against Russia. What's even more insane is that Washington is enraging the Russian people themselves by supporting the massacre through indiscriminate shelling and neo-Nazi stormtrooper blitzes of their fellow Russian speakers in the Donbas right on the border. This is extremely dangerous because, in the final analysis, the Russian state, along with its mountain of H-bombs, depends on the Russian people themselves. If Washington forces Putin to compromise too much, he may lose public support and power, and whatever militant nationalist takes his place may make us long for the days of Putin. Our, quote, security force in Washington is willing to vehemently antagonize an overkill capable nuclear power and risk the lives of all of our families over whether a particular junta rules a particular river basin on the other side of the world. Just think about that. Public war weariness, expressed through voting booths, seems to do little to abate the state's drive to create more enemies for us. War weariness is what enabled Obama, the hope and change peace candidate, to beat the hawks Hillary Clinton and John McCain in the 2008 presidential election. In spite of his mandate for a more sane foreign policy, his European foreign policy somehow ended up in the hands of Victoria Nuland, a crazed neocon who dragged us into the present conflict with Russia. And Clinton herself ended up heading his Department of State, where she led the disastrous regime change policies in Libya and Syria, both of which contributed heavily to the present chaos in the Middle East and North Africa. The imperial deep state will always manage to get its way, no matter what we do at the polls. There is no hope for change through anti-war candidates and legislation. Washington will continue to draw fire toward you and your family, so long as you are associated with it, even if only through the bonds of subjection. We will only be reasonably safe from terrorism and nuclear annihilation when we disentangle ourselves from our enemy maker, the state. That article is by Daniel Sanchez, and you can read that and many other great articles on lewrockwell.com. So thank you very much for tuning into my show this week. I hope that you enjoyed it. This has been a presentation of the Austrian Circle here on 91.7 FM. Stay tuned for all sorts of other great programming from us, and I hope that you have a great week. Take care.